We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here. And we're also pleased to have here with us in the studio Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we do every month on a Monday to give folks who are listening a chance to ask questions about home maintenance issues. So you're thinking of changing something, doing some remodeling, you got some kind of problem, you pick up the telephone and give us a call, and Scott will see if he can help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we will take email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, David. Thanks for having me on.
We do, in fact, have an email from somebody who sent it in advance of the program, and it has to do with air conditioning. And actually, I guess now if you were thinking about maybe this year replacing your air conditioning, this is probably a good place to start thinking about it right now. You don't want to start thinking about it like, you know, June 1st. You probably want to be thinking about it now. So here's the deal. The listener says that he has an 18-year-old furnace and central air conditioning unit. The furnace is a Trane XL90, which is rated 90% efficiency, so that's pretty good. The air conditioner is a Trane XE1000, which has a SEER rating of 10. He says the furnace works fine, but the AC hasn't worked for a number of years, and he says actually he doesn't really use air conditioning very much. Anyway, he says he's thinking what would be better here, either to see what's wrong with it and get it fixed so it was working again, if indeed it can be repaired, or to replace it with a brand new unit. He says, if I replaced it, I would be able to take advantage of energy tax credits offered to reduce that cost, although obviously it would cost more to get it replaced than to get it fixed. And further, he wants to know, from what he's read, to upgrade from a new AC unit, he says he thinks he would have to actually replace the furnace also. Is that true?
Okay. Well, first of all, the SEER rating, or seasonal energy efficiency rating, the 10 SEER that he is indicating, is the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So if I am getting 10 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity, as opposed to an older unit, which may get 6 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity, or one of the new ones, which I believe right now 13 is the lowest you can buy. That is mandated that we have to have a 13 SEER or higher, and 14 and 15 are available. There are some higher, but wow, once you start getting up there in the really super efficient units, they start getting quite expensive. However, also when you start getting into the higher efficiency ones, you have to have the proper evaporator coil in the furnace housing to go with it. It's not that you need to replace the furnace, but you need to replace the evaporator inside the furnace or in the box above the furnace. The furnace and the air conditioner do share the same air handling or the same ductwork and fan in a forced air system. So what they would need to do then would be to replace an outside unit, and with the high efficiency compressor, would have to replace it with a high efficiency evaporator. Now, since you've already got a SEER rating of 10, I would say that I would check and see if you can't get it repaired. And at least check and make sure that it is maybe something relatively simple. It could be that it is low on Freon, and so the low pressure switch has shut it off. It could be something, low voltage transformer not telling it to turn on. So I would definitely have somebody take a look at it, because at a SEER rating of 10, I would not say that it is so inefficient that we can't use it. So my advice in this particular case would be, yes, have a service call made and see how repairable it is. It probably is not a big issue to get it up and running. When you do have to replace it, yes, you will probably end up replacing the coil inside the furnace, but not necessarily the furnace itself. And the 90% efficient furnace is an induced draft furnace, so it is efficient enough that it's not something that needs to be replaced right away either, as long as it's in normal working condition.
Okay. So, though, if you were, say, you were going to go and buy a new air conditioner today, so first of all, you said that the lowest SEER rating you could get now is the 13, is there, and I'm not sure what the difference is in the price, say, between a 13 and a 15, but how do you make that decision about the level of efficiency and then balance that off also with the price?
Yes, there is a price increase. I don't know right off the top of my head what the increase would be or the jump would be between the 15 and the 13. But yes, you would have to kind of balance it out. If in this case, a caller apparently does not use air conditioning on a regular basis, it probably would not be worth the extra jump to run up to the 15 SEER as opposed to the 13 SEER. But that would have to be based on your particular usage. In my position, I run air conditioning quite a bit. Matter of fact, I'm probably getting ready to turn it on anytime it hits about 65 out. And yes, a 15 would probably work much better for me than a 13. So I'd probably go the extra mile, the extra expense to get the energy savings. Generally speaking, an air conditioner compressor lasts about 10 to 15 years is what they're considered to be normal lifespan on them, which is fine because right now our technology is getting good enough on air conditioners that we get them outdated almost that fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, hopefully that helps the caller. We have some other people who are on the line right now ready to go, and we will go to someone in Lafayette, which is line 4. Hello.
Hello. First, I'd like to ask what you think of what I'll call a roof shovel. Actually, it's a blade on a long handle to pull the snow off the edge of the house, off the edge of the roof, as you stand on the pavement. Is that good in preventing ice jams at the edge?
Probably not very effective. First of all, I don't like using large, heavy items on shingles that are cold and brittle. You can tend to break the shingles, and a roof shovel is designed to cut the shingles and tear them off for doing roof repair. And granted, from the ground, just reaching up there with something, you'd probably be better off with, if you really needed to move some snow, you'd probably be better off with a broom. A large push broom or something would have about an equally long handle on it that would get you up about as high and would not have the tendency to damage the shingles. It doesn't have the sharp edges. As far as preventing ice damming, most of the time an ice dam is formed by the heat in the attic warming up the snow, the water running down the roof as it melts.
Now melting it temporarily.
Yeah, and then, well, when it gets back to the overhang or out to the overhang where it's not over the attic area itself, it doesn't have as much heat, so it tends to refreeze, and so we end up with this ice dam or ice buildup at the end of the roof. And yeah, a broom is not going to break up the ice. I suppose a shovel could, but if the ice is frozen down to the shingles, you do really stand a chance of damaging the shingles themselves while trying to get that ice off of there. Probably the best bet is what we need to do is get a little bit more insulation in the attic so we don't have as much melt and more ventilation in the attic so that it that upper portion of the roof is the same temperature as the lower portion of the roof. We don't get quite as much ice damming. We did have a little bit of that this year in that we had several days of some really, really cold weather. It got warm, and then it froze back up again. So I did get a few calls on ice damming. Usually it's more prominent in a lower pitch roof, something that doesn't have as much slope to it. But, yeah, I really have a hard time saying that a steel-bladed shovel is a good way of playing with your roof because you're too likely to damage the shingles.
Okay. The damp weather makes me ask, how do I remove green moss starting to form on concrete and small stone? I fear it'll be a hazard to someone walking there.
Okay. Anytime we do get a lot of high humidity, we can get some moss or mildew growing on things. Usually a high-pressure washer for things like concrete, steps, and stones will take it right off. For siding or something a little bit softer, I don't like to use a high pressure on it, so I would recommend something more of brushing on a mild mixture of bleach and water, usually a 4-to-1 mixture or something like that to try and kill off the moss and a stiff brush. I have recommended for vinyl siding on regular occasion a brush that would use similar to a car wash brush, something designed for a motorhome or something with a long extended handle for the sides of the house. But in this particular case, you're referring to strictly a concrete. There's no reason why you couldn't just use a good high-pressure washer and wash it off.
Well, some of the stone is next to grass.
Okay, so you would, yeah, with the stone you can still wash with a high pressure washer, but you don't want to use the bleach because we don't want to kill the grass.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. On again to another caller. We have next someone in St. Charles, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. This is a heating and cooling question. I mean, you guys were talking about heaters and furnaces and whatnot. I've had a couple of people come into my house when I've had things done in my furnace. The guy says, you got to replace it. There's nothing wrong with it. And I think they're trying to get me to buy a particular kind of heater. And the problem I have is it's like every heating and cooling guy you talk to right now wants to sell you something, even though there's nothing wrong with my heater. And there isn't. I'm in the building trades myself, and I kind of, the only thing I don't touch is the furnaces. Although I will admit I've changed my motor, the controller, the black box. I've changed just about everything in there except for the burners, and it actually operates well. It's not the best, but as far as energy efficient. But all these guys are saying that the administration is going to give you a rebate if you replace this and this. Well, I think $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 later, you're replacing it, and you may get $1,500, not from the company you're buying it from. It's from the government. I was just wondering what you think about that, or trying to keep maintain this. It's about 15 years old, so I was kind of considering what you would think with all these rebates, if that's a good deal or what.
Well, I try and stay as far away from anything political as I can. Tax credits and such, it's not something that I usually deal with, so I don't know exactly which credits are available out there for what. I realize that they are trying to get the higher efficiency appliances into the houses to help the country overall to save energy usage. And so if you have an entitlement to a tax credit for something like that, it is something to take into consideration. But a 15-year-old unit probably is still a functional unit and doesn't necessarily need to be replaced on efficiency alone. Now, if it had some type of issue that needed repairs, I don't know that I would put a lot of money into it, keeping it up and running, because it could be a lower efficiency unit. At 15 years old, it may still be an 85 or 90% efficient unit or 80% efficient unit. So I would not say it needs to be replaced on age and efficiency alone. But the problem with – you indicated that it had a new fan and a new control box, things like that. Well, the only thing really left then would be the heat exchanger. And as long as the heat exchanger does not have a crack or hole in it, which would allow the combustion gases to mix with the house gases, then you're absolutely correct in assuming that you could keep it up and running by putting a lot of parts in it. However, if it gets to the point where it's taking more parts and more energy to run it, then it's maybe time to consider replacing it.
But, yeah. Well, those two things together, the possibility that you could get some kind of a rebate, that and the fact that energy costs continue to go up, I'm sure that gets people thinking, is it the time to replace my unit? Now, they may know how old it is. They may not even know, for example, and we've been living in our house for 20 years and it was there when we got there, and I don't know how old our furnace is. Is there some way that you can find out or figure out what level of efficiency your furnace is operating at?
For the layperson that's not familiar with furnaces, there's no real easy way of telling on most of them. We did have the email which said we had a Trane XL90. Technically, that was supposed to be a 90% efficient furnace. So if you happen to have a Trane XL model that would have that a number similar to that, an 80, 85, 90, that would give you an idea. Usually the older furnaces are larger in physical size because they're not as efficient, so they had to have a bigger burner for more BTUs of cool or heating for the or not BTUs of heating but more heat produced by the larger flame or more flame, get more hot air. When you're only using say 75% of the heat to heat the house, you're going to have to create a lot more of it than if you're using 90% of the heat to heat the house. If you have one that has an induction fan, in other words, when you turn it on, you hear a little fan start up before the burner kicks on, that is usually an indication of an 80 to 85% efficient fan. If you've got one that has a plastic PVC pipe for a vent pipe, that's usually an indication of a condensing style furnace or a 90 or 90 plus furnace. So, I mean, there's a couple little things there, but for the most part, you just don't walk up to it and go, oh, that's a 45% efficient furnace. Well, now I take that back. If you have one of these big old octopus things that is 6 feet in diameter and the return air duct is almost 2 foot in diameter, you need to throw that away. That's about 45 to 50% efficient, but I haven't been running into too many of those here lately.
Yeah, okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here every month. It's always a Monday, and we take questions on home maintenance. So if you were thinking about furnaces or air conditioning or anything else in your house, if you're thinking about energy efficiency or you got some kind of problem and you're not really quite sure how to deal with it, if you give us a call, Scott will try and help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we have someone else here getting ready to go, and they're all set. In Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about a deck that I had replaced with pressure-treated wood about 4 or 5 years ago, and I never got any finish on it, and now it looks terrible. So I'm wondering, what do I do to clean it up, and how do I clean it up, and what do I put on it for an appropriate finish?
Okay, well, they do definitely make a deck cleaner, which will help take some of the graying out and bring back some of the natural color of the lumber. So I think you'll find that most of the do-it-yourself stores do sell a deck cleaner, which requires usually a stiff brush and a bucket and a good hose, a lot of water. It does bring the color back pretty well. I do recommend putting some type of sealant on the deck, not necessarily a paint, but something more in the way of a repellent.
Would you use varnish?
I would not, because the varnish would sit on the top, and it tend in a high traffic area such as a deck, the varnish tends to get damaged, and once you start getting some spots wear thin or start flaking loose, it's very difficult to get it even color or even texture again once that starts wearing out. So no, I would not use a varnish. That's why I don't usually recommend a paint for a deck, but a stain or a water repellent. Most of the water repellents, it's not necessarily the water we're worried about, it's more the UV protection that they provide. Here in central Illinois, where we do get quite a bit of rain, but it's pressure-treated lumber, it's really not going to rot. We do get an awful lot of UV damage or sunlight damage, and that's what's taking the color out of your deck. That's why it's turning
gray.
Yeah. The deck cleaners will bring back a lot of that. It'll help take off some of the dead oxidized wood cells on the surface. Once you get the deck cleaned, then you put a water repellent on it, which has some type of UV protectant, and that will help reduce the effects the sunlight have on it and help reduce some of the cracking and such like that as the deck gets a little bit older.
Is that a clear product?
Most of the time, the water repellents are generally a clear. You can put on a stain. A stain will work. However, there again, your high traffic areas may tend to wear faster than the outer areas, so the deck doesn't always maintain an even color. So yes, the clear units, clear type finishes are usually pretty good.
So if I go to the Do It Best hardware store, would they have the deck cleaner and this water repellent UV protection? They'd know what I was talking about.
They should, yes.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Now, I'm just I'm thinking about the fact that in the past we've talked about waterproofing and sealants for various kinds of materials, and for example, people have asked questions about brick. And I think that you've always said, no, you don't want to put a sealer on brick, particularly if it's on the side of your house, because you don't want to trap moisture under
there. That is correct.
Now, when it comes to wood, though, it seems to me that there are, again, for products like decks, there are varieties of products that either talk about being sealers or they talk about being water repellents. And to me, that says, okay, we're talking about some sort of different level of sealing here. Now, as far as wood decks go, do you recommend something that really would be a sealer, or is it what you're really going for is something that will help it shed the water, but we're talking about two different things here?
Well, like I say, the problem with the sealers is, generally speaking, they have a surface coat. A paint is a sealer. A varnish is a sealer. That type of a hard surface coat can get cracking, checking, peeling, and then to replace it, you end up doing sanding and things like that to try and even out the spots that have discolored underneath it. Whereas the water repellents kind of soak down into the wood, the stains, they soak down into the wood. So instead of sitting on the top, they actually get a little bit better coverage, a little bit better depth into the lumber, and in my opinion, give a little bit better protection. And you do find one that has some type of a UV repellent or protection to help reduce the sunlight effect. If you don't mind painting your deck once every 2 years, well, paint will work quite well as a sealant. It will protect the wood. Generally give you a nice looking deck, but you do have to redo it on a regular basis, and it's going to take more effort than just putting a repellent down. So it kind of depends on how much maintenance you want to do to the deck.
Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody else. Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Say, a couple of years ago, I believe your dad gave a recommendation on a wood repellent. I think it was Seal Treat. Wood preservative, and I had to order it, I forget, out of a hardware store, I think in Peoria. Is there a name you can recommend on a clear wood preservative repellent?
Well, the Seal Treat or Seal Treat 2 is a good product. It is not always real easy to find. Right now, there are several different companies out there making products for decks, and it's hard for me to stay on top of which one is absolutely the best or which one's not. I would say go through there. Not necessarily the most popular brands, because some of them tend to get along with their name more than they do their actual productivity.
I think your dad didn't recommend Thompson's, but, you know, I guess the formulas change, and that was a few years ago, so maybe.
That is absolutely correct. At one point in time, what we were seeing with the Thompson seal was that you had to put a repellent on every 2 years or every year and a half, and I personally think that they should last longer. Now they have a 4 or 5 year formula, and that would work just fine.
But the Seal Treat, I can't find it online. I didn't think it was made anymore.
Well, I'm not sure that I've tried to look it up here lately. I know I've seen it. It hasn't been all that long ago, but it's something I haven't tried to pick up here lately. I'd have to check into that. But,
okay. Hey, what on another matter? If you have asbestos wrap pipes in a basement, the old, you know, the thick, not the paper wrap, but the thick type around, like if you have steam pipes. Is wrapping with duct tape or foil tape, is that a legitimate way of covering it up?
Yes, that is actually considered to be an encapsulation. You can wrap it with plastic and then seal the ends with duct tape, basically something to keep the fibers from becoming airborne. The type of insulation you're referring to usually has some type of it almost looks like a cardboard, but the ends are usually some type of plaster.
Yeah.
And that stuff does deteriorate what we call friable ends, where it can the fibers can come loose and become airborne. So, yeah, wrapping it in duct tape or wrapping it with a plastic that has the end sealed with the duct tape, anything just prevent the fibers from becoming airborne is considered to be a viable encapsulation.
When you do an inspection and you see the pipes wrapped with tape or whatever, it doesn't raise a red flag to you?
Well, we have put the little small print disclaimer at the bottom of things, but it does mean that I indicate there is some asbestos in the house, but that it has or appears to have been encapsulated, so it should not become airborne. I also try and indicate that, generally speaking, the problems with asbestos in most cases has been highly overrated. Generally, the exposure you get from a home asbestos or even in light, inside buildings already in that have been built usually is a very mild exposure. If you had exposure to work levels where you were working someplace where they were applying asbestos or sealing things with asbestos, it's a different story than just walking in and out of a workplace or in a basement or something where you're, you know, unless you're grinding it up and inhaling it, you're really not going to come in contact with large quantities of asbestos. So the encapsulation is a perfectly acceptable method of controlling it.
There's no I called a furnace supply house once and asked. I thought I heard someone call it like a diaper that you wrap, and they had no idea what I was talking about. Is there a product like you described? You know, duct tape is pretty narrow. You can spend a lot of hours doing it. Is there a wider wrap for that type of?
The commercially available product that I've seen has been more of more like a split plastic tube that you would slide over the top of it, and then you would seal the seam on the tube and then tape the ends. And it's a real light gauge plastic. Usually it would be one of the heating supply stores. I haven't installed it myself, so I haven't tried to go out and actually find some. But I see it quite often in apartment buildings that have the steam heater, hot water heat. And so I know it is something that at least most of the commercial guys are using, but I don't know about whether or not the residential suppliers have it or not.
Hey, real quick on another matter, why would water heaters and roof shingles in the worst building recession we've had in 30, 40 years, why would they still be at such high levels? I know roof shingles have oil, you know, product in them, but why wouldn't products like that come down like drywall and lumber? Water heaters are $350, almost $400. I know they had to upgrade them safety-wise, but they more than doubled, and same with roof shingles.
I'm sure it has something to do with the production changes. Anything that's made in a factory these days, we have a lot more safety issues, so that the production prices go up. But quite honestly, I don't make water heaters, so I'm not quite sure why they went up. I have noticed that they have done so, because it used to be I could go out and buy a water heater for $200, $225, and yeah, they've shot up to $400, $450 here in recent years.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Our guest in this hour of focus is Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program here once a month, always a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. So your questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's if you're in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, somebody who was listening heard this conversation about wood protection products and apparently says that your dad likes something called a brand called Total Wood Protection.
That's another one of the ones that is recommended. He gets some information from people that do wood research, mostly down in the Texas area, where they do a lot of work with cedar and things like that. So, yeah, we do make some recommendations for a few brands when we do inspections. Here on the radio, I try not to get too brand specific. I don't want to get myself in any trouble, but yeah, that is the Total Seal does work well as well. Also, but like I say, even Thompson, at one point in time, we were saying not to use it, and it was because the formula that they had just did not last. It wasn't that it didn't work. You just had to apply it on a regular basis, and they've changed their formula, and they've done some more work with it. And so I can't go out there now and say, oh, well, I wouldn't use that product, because if it's going to last 4 or 5 years, then it's as good a product as just about everything else. So.
Yeah. And if you your deck really does not look good and it's got stuff growing on there, might you also have to get you a pressure washer and maybe do that first?
Pressure washing on decks is a little dicey. If you're using a smaller unit that doesn't put up a lot of pressure, you know, 900,000 PSI, you can do pretty well. But it's very easy to do damage to the deck. If you get the nozzle too close or you get too high a pressure, the wood is soft enough, you will actually cut the wood. So usually for decks, I don't recommend pressure washing unless they're just in absolute horrible condition. Usually a good stiff bristle brush and one of the deck cleaners, and just wash it, just broom it, and that'll usually clean it up.
Okay. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Questions are welcome. We got some other folks lined up, and we'll talk next with someone in Terre Haute. Line four. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Yeah.
I agree with you that the just a good cleaner and a good stiff brush and a good nozzle on your garden hose will do a real good job of cleaning the deck. My question is, what's your opinion of the water-based deck sealants? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, they do have the water-based units, and they do a nice cleanup. It depends on, you know, there's 10 or 12 different water-based units out there, so I can't comment on any particular one. I would look for something that indicates that it has some type of longevity. In other words, something that says it is good for 4 or 5 years. I would look for something that says it has a UV protection, something to keep the sun from deteriorating the lumber. But as far as the individual products, I would try not to go into, you know, what works and what doesn't. First of all, I don't want to stick my neck out too far when products change. It's kind of hard to stand on top of them. My guess is go take a look, read the cans. Most of the time, they'll give you some indication of what we're looking at. If it says you need to apply it every 1 to 2 years, I would probably look for something else that usually doesn't last long enough to make it worth putting on there. I like the water base in that they're easy cleanup. They're easy on the yard around it, particularly if you've got a lot of grass next to the deck. Mm-hmm. And as a general rule, they don't have quite as much odor, so you don't end up with that smell for the next 2 or 3 days after you do your deck. So, yes, I will say I do like the water-based products. You just have to watch and make sure you know what it is that you're getting.
Okay. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I wanted to ask Scott what his father's phone number is because he very kindly gave me some information on radon the other day, but I haven't had any luck talking to his father about a possible contractor locally. Could you give me that phone number, or how do you want to?
Actually, you can get a hold of him at our business office. I'm usually go out and do the inspections, and he's usually the one answering the phone. So if you were just to call us at the office, he'd be more than happy to talk to you.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Other questions again, and welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Anything else that's really, occasionally there are things where particular parts of the times of the year, there's something that's really seasonal, and we say, well, now this is a good thing to be thinking about now. And actually, we started out talking about air conditioning, and I said, and you sort of nodded, that if you're thinking about replacing your air conditioning, yeah, this would be a good time to start thinking about what you're doing. Anything else that's this you'd say, yeah, at this time of the year, here's something to think about?
Actually, there is, and it's something that most people will check, but occasionally gets overlooked, and that is the springtime is a good time to check your crawl space. If you haven't looked in it in a while, it's probably not a bad idea. Now, even if you don't feel like you want to go down into the crawl space, at least pull the cover and take a look down there and see if you see standing water or something that looks incorrect. If the plastic is deteriorated and you can see the soil surface, maybe it's time for a new vapor barrier. The vapor barrier, of course, we've talked over and over about how important that is. So if it's nice and bright in that crawl space, some crawl spaces have window accesses, some have wide open vents, and the more light you get down the crawl space, the faster the plastic will deteriorate. So if it's nice and bright without a flashlight, you may have to replace that vapor barrier more often or put in a dark or UV-protected type vapor barrier, a black plastic instead of a clear plastic. But yeah, I would highly recommend that if you haven't looked in your crawl space lately, this would be a good time to do it. We've had our big snow melt. We had snow around for weeks and weeks and weeks, and all of a sudden it all melted, and it melted because we ended up with lots and lots of rain. So with the amount of water that we've got out there, stick your head down there. I do know that this time of year I start carrying my hip waders, so that when I get into houses, occasionally we find the big surprise of 4 or 5 inches of water standing down in the crawl space. So.
Okay. And just in case anybody, I mean, we've talked about it so many times, but in case anybody's not sure what we're talking about, your recommendation always has been that the surface in the crawl space, the dirt that's down there, should be covered by a sheet of plastic.
That's correct. have to have some type of vapor barrier so that the natural water evaporation out of the soil doesn't come up into the house and keep the humidity in the house too high. Particularly, everybody knows that mold and mildew is one of these problems that is becoming more and more prevalent. It's not that we're getting more and more mold and mildew. It's that we're making the houses more energy efficient and tighter, so we're not getting as much airflow through it. So a high humidity from any source will tend to stay in the house for longer periods of time, which will allow the mold and mildew to grow. And one of the primary causes, in at least in central Illinois here, is water from soil, though, just the moisture coming up out of the ground.
Okay, and we're not talking about anything fancy. It doesn't have to be taped to the sides. It just has to lay over the dirt.
That's correct. Now, the more we get concerned with radon, of course, if you're trying to make it more a little bit tighter, yes, you can use large pieces and tape the edges. If you actually did a radon test, you can and came up high, you could then put a perforated pipe underneath the plastic, which you would then vent to the outside and basically suck the air from the soil underneath the plastic and blow it outside. So, yeah, just it doesn't take a whole lot to unroll it. Most of the time, the plastic, you buy it on a roll that's about 3 foot wide, but it unfolds to about 16 feet or 15 feet. I know you can buy it in 10, 12, I think it's 14, 16, and you figure out how wide it is between your pillars, your supports in the crawl space, and unroll it from one end to the other and then unfold it from there and cut it around the center piers. It takes about 2 hours to put in plastic in most crawl spaces, unless they're really, really tight or have a lot of debris down there. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend putting down a second layer of plastic. If you have a vapor barrier down in the crawl space that is deteriorating, you want to take that one out before you put a new one in. We don't want to get areas where we've got two layers of plastic where we could actually trap moisture between the two layers of plastic that then cannot evaporate because under a vapor barrier, but can't soak into the soil because it's on top of a sheet of plastic, and you end up with a stagnant water, which will grow all sorts of interesting types of fungus and, pond life.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Here, and let's talk with somebody on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question that's kind of related to what you were just discussing, mold and mildew issues. Our house is surrounded by mature trees, and we get more shade than sun, and we have some issues with mold on the exterior wall and roof. And I wonder what we can do to get rid of it and to keep it from happening coming again.
It's probably not mold as much as it is almost an algae, a plant growth, rather than a mold spore. And in that type of area where you have a lot of shade and you have a lot of mature trees and it holds moisture, yeah, that does happen. And they do make some basically algicides, not necessarily something you'd put in the swimming pool, but something similar. They do make some coatings for both roof applications and for siding applications, which will help reduce the plant life or plant growth on things. Here again, I don't have a product that I recommend on any one particular thing, but it's definitely available where you can apply either. If you've got a natural wood with no stain on it whatsoever, you would put on a clear repellent that would have some type of algicide or some type of mildew resistant chemicals. If you're putting on a roof, they do make it. Off the top of my tongue, I can't remember the one that we've used in the past for doing shingles, but I know that it is basically sprayed on with a garden hose, and it does help reduce the growth on there. But
terrific. I wouldn't even have known that it was algae. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my guess is it's more of an algae than it is a mold. An algae or a mildew, it is a plant growth, so it doesn't take a lot to kill it off.
Terrific. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. On again, number two, line number two here, Urbana. Hello.
I have a question about leaving my house for a long period of time, like for 3 or 4 months, and wanting to be sure that I leave it so that I don't neglect something and there's damage. Can you give me some suggestions?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would not turn the heat or Air conditioning completely off. Air conditioning you probably don't need in most areas, but definitely the heating, I would not turn it all the way down. I try and recommend not less than about 50, 55 degrees.
Okay.
You get much colder than that, first of all. It's very difficult on water pipes if there's any cold air near them that you can get some freezing. Also, as you really dry the house out when it gets that cold, you get a lot of shrinkage. You might come home and find some new cracks in the walls and ceilings and such. So, you know, 55 degrees is about as low as I like to see it set.
Okay.
If you're going to leave the house for an extended period of time, of course, it's a good idea to find the main water shutoff valve and just shut the water off. When you do that, you really should turn the pilot light off on the water heater. That way, if something were to happen where the water pipes were to drain or the water heater were to drain, we don't have a flame source trying to boil the water in the water heater. So I do recommend turning a pilot light off on the water heater if you turn the water main off to the house.
Okay.
And turning the water main off is not usually is not a difficult thing to do. You find the water meter. There's usually a valve on it, at least one, if not both sides of it, that will turn off all the water to the house. That way, if something were to happen, particularly with the heat down, a pipe would break. The only water you'd end up with is the water that is in the pipes, and not and you wouldn't sit there and pay for the house to be flooded.
It's always
kind of upsetting to walk into the basement, not only have 4 inches of water in the basement, but realize you paid for the water that's in the basement. So, turning that off, as far as electrical and stuff, I probably would not bother tripping a main breaker, but, you know, just make sure most things are off. High current draw items such as a refrigerator, if you've got it emptied out, you could turn it off and leave the doors in the refrigerator open so we don't get mold and mildew inside the refrigerator. If you're going to leave stuff in there, obviously you want to leave it turned on. As long as nobody's opening and closing the door and it's a relatively newer refrigerator, it will be efficient enough that it shouldn't run all the time. But a refrigerator does draw a lot more power than people would normally think.
Right. So if it was left at closer to 40, that might be okay? There wasn't anything really perishable in there.
Actually, the refrigerator temperature isn't the issue. It's how much heat loss it – or how much cooling loss is through the doors and seals
and such. Okay.
The compressor itself takes a fair amount of energy. Turning it the temperature up in the refrigerator is not going to save you much because it's still going to have some cooling loss through all the doors, the seals, the ice maker. There's a couple openings on the back that we tend to get some air movement through there. A refrigerator is never airtight because you get it airtight and then you, like I say, you get the mold and mildew in there. So there's always some air leakage.
Right. Okay.
Well, I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. The biggest one, of course, and the one that does the most damage is usually water. So shutting that off, and the thing I have to stress is when you shut the water off, make sure you turn the pilot light off for the water heater as well.
Good point. I would not have thought of that, but that's going to be very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. And we have about 10 minutes, a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here once a month on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Savoy is up next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question about the VistaClean in the crawl space, which you were talking about earlier. Over many years, from people going down in there or me to do different things, holes, for example, we had to replace our dryer exhaust, which runs through our crawl space to the outside wall. And he tore, as he was working, some holes in the VistaClean. So I went down there, and I don't know if I did the right thing, but I just took like a trash bag, and I, because one of the holes was fairly big, and I stuck it through the hole and then tried to spread it out to keep that, you know, plastic there. Is that the wrong thing to do? And what do I do about all the smaller holes? Do I duct tape them? Or I'm not sure what the best way to handle that is, the damage, you know, that was done.
Well, actually, the repair you did was quite good for that area. If you get a larger hole, yes, you can put another trash bag. Works well. It's a little thinner, so it doesn't is not as durable, but it is very effective as a vapor barrier. When you figure out just how big the crawl space is, and then you start thinking about a few small holes here and there, we're looking at a very small percentage of the actual vapor barrier that has been compromised. Once you start getting a lot of tears and a lot of holes, or if the plastic starts deteriorating, you just take out that piece and put down an entire new piece of plastic. I think you can put all new plastic in a crawl space for about $65 or $70. Of course, that doesn't include the time and effort to put it down there. That's just the materials.
Right.
But some small holes and such, I don't know that I would get that worried about.
Okay.
Because as long as you've got that vapor barrier over, say, 95 or 98% of the crawl space, and you're reducing that much moisture coming up into the house, it's still being pretty effective.
Okay. It's always been a fairly dry crawl space, and there is pea gravel under the VisiClean. So we've never really had any water in it or that I've noticed, you know, any standing or under a lot of humidity under the plastic. So, well, okay, so if I wanted to tape the small holes, I mean, I don't need to worry about it. I understand it from what you've said, but if I wanted to, that would be a thing I could do.
Yeah, something like a duct tape would work quite well.
Right. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And we had, and again, just from somebody I think who wants to be clear on why it is they're doing this and what happens when they do this. The idea is that there is moisture in the soil. What you don't want is for that moisture to evaporate up into the house. So the idea is that any moisture in the soil, it's going to come up, it's going to hit that plastic, and it's going to stay there, and eventually will get
it's soaked back down
reabsorbed
into the ground,
back
yeah.
into the ground.
Yeah, the way the earth works, basically, our plant life, there is always moisture in the soil that is coming up to help the plants get moisture to the roots, et cetera. We've cut all the wood down for the house, therefore it is not still growing, so we don't need to feed it any more moisture. The house itself would rather be drier, actually drier than what you would like to have the house. The drier the house, generally speaking, the longer things will last. But if you start getting it too dry, of course, we start getting static shocks and nosebleeds and things like that. So I would keep the house as dry as you can handle it without being uncomfortable in the house. It's amazing how much water will move. When water evaporates and becomes a water vapor, vapor moves by vapor pressure. Vapor pressure will try and equalize throughout a structure. So a little bit of water anywhere in the house will mean you have a little bit of water everywhere in the house. And water will, as a vapor, will start condensing on cold surfaces. A damp crawl space can shorten the life of shingles 3 to 5 years. I get more people looking at me with a real quizzical look on that. Well, the attic is above the insulation, so it's one of the coldest spots in the house. So if you have moisture anywhere, it will tend to, and it's evaporated, that water vapor will tend to condense out of the air when it hits a cold surface. So quite often we end up with water actually condensing in the roof area or in the attic area. And even when you can't see it in the attic, it may be condensing on the shingles because plywood is not a vapor barrier. Carpet is not a vapor barrier. This water will move through floors, doors, walls, anything except a vapor barrier such as plastic or glass. So the putting the vapor barrier down on the soil surface, which is probably where most of the moisture is going to start, that is going to reduce the moisture levels in the house the best. And so that's why I consider it to be very, very important as far as reducing mold and mildew, extending life on shingles, just in general keeping the house in good condition.
And do you ever see a problem with water somehow getting on top of the plastic in a crawl space?
Well, yes, of course. The area we have here where we have so much clay, we don't get a lot of percolation in the soil. The water doesn't necessarily run down. It tends to run across. Yeah, I see it come in crawl space vents, things like that. You leave, even with the vent closed, if you get water up to a vent, water's going to come into the crawl space. Ideally, the plastic should be lapped up the walls enough that when that water runs down the walls, it runs underneath the plastic or behind the plastic and not on top of it. But yes, it is not uncommon to find a little bit of water on top of the plastic. It doesn't usually last very long, usually evaporates, comes up into the house. But yeah, if you've got a house that it starts getting a lot of water on the plastic, we need to figure out, okay, what do we do to the plastic that allows that? Because generally speaking, the plastic will float on top of the water. If you were to have some flooding, as long as the water doesn't start out on top, as long as it comes from underneath, usually the plastic will float. Now, of course, the more gravel you put on it, storage items, things like that, that will help ballast the plastic down. You don't really want that. Mm-hmm. That plastic should be laid down on top of all the gravel. If you've got any wood materials underneath there, they should actually come out before you put the plastic down. Cardboard, things like that, are not good in a crawl space, top or bottom, unless it's really dry down there. Every once in a while, I get somebody that's used the crawl space for storage. That works if you have a really good vapor barrier. I mean, you've got it sealed up really tight. Otherwise, whatever you store down there is probably going to come back out smelling like mold and mildew.
Okay. I'll go at least one more call here. Clay City, line 4. Hello.
Yeah. I've got a question about a crawl space, too. I was wondering about insulating my crawl space, but I was wanting to insulate the blocks around the crawl space rather than the floor so I didn't lose the heat from my ductwork. Is that a feasible idea or not?
That is the current recommendation that I'm sticking with. I did see some study come across not too long ago that said that they were could actually save more by putting it in the floor, but I think that they were working in an area that was like California where they didn't have heat loss problems anyway. It would make sense to me since the soil level or soil temperatures in this area is going to be about 55 degrees pretty much year round. 55 degrees is fairly easy to heat up a couple degrees and get up to what I'll call a warm temperature of 65 or 68. So a little bit of heat loss from your ductwork, warming the crawl space. The warm air rises, it warms the floors. So, yes, I do recommend insulating the perimeter walls rather than the floors.
What do you recommend insulating that with?
It depends on your crawl space. If it's nice and totally dry down there, they make a spray-on insulation. It's basically a fiberglass and glue mixture that they can spray on and seal it up. You can use 2-inch polystyrene foam board, preferably not the bead board, the extruded board. You put a mastic, some type of adhesive on the wall, something that, of course, does not react with styrofoam. It's amazing how many glues will actually melt styrofoam. Something like a liquid nails type of mastic, you can just put on with a caulking gun, put a zigzag on your block, take your styrofoam and stick it up there. That works well. Then you would insulate your band joist areas with either cut pieces of foam or cut pieces of fiberglass. One of the best ways is they spray urethane foam. It's probably the more expensive way, but it seals up all air cracks, air leakage, et cetera, and does a real nice job of sealing things up.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Well, we seem to get one more here. Fisher, line 1. Hello.
Yes. I look at a lot of problems with ventilation and roofs.
Mm-hmm.
We got to kind of be quick here. We don't have a lot of time. We want to try to do your question.
What I would like to know, in these problem areas, because it's various configurations where air doesn't move, condensation takes place on the sheathing, drips into the insulation, and discolors the drywall. If you put plastic down to collect that condensation melt, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, you don't want to put a vapor barrier on top of the insulation in the attic because then it does act as a vapor barrier and moisture from the house will collect on that vapor barrier. You need to, if you're going to put a vapor barrier for an attic area, it has to be under at least 6 inches insulation. Now stop and think, that moisture that's condensing in the attic, that's not necessarily starting in the attic. You need to find the moisture source. Ventilating will help, but let's find the source of the moisture rather than just try and ventilate whatever is up there out. And if you've got enough that it's collecting on the plastic, we definitely have a water source somewhere in the house that we need to try and figure out where that's coming from because that water is not originating in the crawl space or in the attic. It's ending up in the attic because of the temperature difference.
Okay, we got to quit there. My apologies for having to make that kind of short, but we're at the end of the time. Scott will be back next month. We'll do it again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David.
Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, almost on Monday, on the third Monday, for us to do this show. We also want to thank Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. We're going to break at this point so we can bring you an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.